Notice something else he does. He begins talking about the petty pace and we get. We get the little T sound. Creeps in this petty pace. And you can almost, the actor quite literally in saying the words has to spit them out. It is contempt. Creeps in this petty pace. And then from day to day, the sound is creating the meaning. To the last syllable of recorded time. Wait a minute. I'll pound it out for you. To the last syllable of recorded time. Kaboom! Kaboom! Okay? The meter of the line goes completely askew. Okay? To the last syllable of recorded. Maybe, but all of a sudden we have to check. It is quite, let me put it this way. The meter of this line goes completely haywire. Completely haywire. And he prepares us for it because he had just established a regular beat again in the previous line. Creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. If you'll notice, the first word here that gets an accent has to be last. Okay? Followed by syllable of recorded time. It is totally irregular. And he emphasizes the lack of regularity by short, short, long, long. Short, 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 long, short, long. Let me just say what we have here is metric chaos. Total disorder to the last syllable of recorded time. And notice the only place that order comes back in, last 2 feet of the line, when he talks about what? Recorded time. Who's doing the recording? Well, either those who are still alive to write it down, or if we assume that there is an end point, we all know what the last moment of recorded time is going to signify. Order comes back again, and we know whose order it is. Now, there are a couple of other games being played here. There's a pun. Shakespeare loves puns. Whenever you find a pun in Shakespeare, it's intentional. To the last syllable, bull, bull, bull. Sounds like what? Bell, bell, bell. Recorded time. How do we record time? The ringing of a bell, okay? To the last syllable of recorded time. We have the L sounds. We have the A again, last, day, day, pace, okay? The repeated vowel sounds again. The sounds are being ordered in a particular way. First three lines. We're just through the first three lines of this. But what we're doing is quite literally stretching out time, making it insignificant, having huge metric disorder, and then regularity as we end talking about, indeed, the end of recorded time. Let me put the next few lines up here. Okay. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools. We're pretty close to being regular here. And yet, again, in speaking it, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools, we actually get, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools. We're missing a beat, and we're getting all, the L sounds are picked up from last syllable.
our yesterdays, and suddenly notice what's happening in time. The hideous vision of that future, tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, now reverts to the past. He quite literally turns around and looks the other direction. It is a man nearing the end of his life, evaluating that life and saying, it has been meaningless. However, the line is contradicting it. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death, except what is the image used with yesterday? Light. Light. Again, an acknowledgement that in his past there was light. In the same way, if you will, that buried in tomorrow is the sense of the coming of a morning, of a new dawn. In the midst of this nihilism, there is this yearning for either what was or constant references, brief glimpses of light. And all our yesterdays have light. And notice what Shakespeare does to emphasize the word light. We get the accent on all, the one on yes. Days would get at most a secondary accent because we're running forward and all our yesterdays have. And as we speak about the past, it becomes insignificant. Accent on yes, on light. Contradicting the meaning of the line. There is something pulling in an opposite direction. But he can only get that effect because he is using the rhythm. He's using the meter. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools. But boom, there it is. Except remember, the last syllable of recorded time suggests judgment. And yet, here is Macbeth doing what? Judging. They're all fools. It is again Macbeth playing God by attempting to judge all the other human beings in the world who are merely fools. And the past is nothing more than a way of deluding idiots, fools, to move towards death. It is, if you will, perhaps a hint of the vision of the what was called the will-o'-the-wisp. The phony light that would lead a traveler astray into the swamp. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. And the first part of this line is regular in rhythm. The way to dusty death. Regular rhythm is there, but what it leads to is the accent on death, on dust, and way. And we also get the internal rhymes from day to day, yesterdays, the way, day, day, days, way. Long vowel sounds again, the long A sound, pulling the time out. And the connection of the D sounds, day, dusty, death. The words, if you will, are accumulating around a center. The way to dusty death. And then, out, out, brief candle. Out, out, brief candle. The strong statement that ends the line with that double out, out. Again, the vowel sounds are awful, and they're stretched out. Out, out, brief can, ah. And in the midst of it is a short vowel sound. Brief, brief, brief. The word is doing what he's talking about. It's tough to put it out. It takes forever. Out, out, but the candle is brief, brief. A little word is just sort of spirited in there, has to get an accent. But it is surrounded by these long vowel sounds, which makes the word brief sound brief. And in speaking it, it doesn't take as much time. Out, out, brief candle. Brief candle. And it ends with weakness. Boom, another feminine ending. The line falls off. There's an extra unaccented beat that comes after four strong ones. It's called a spondee, double accents. Boom. But the final suggestion is weakness in the man, even as he is trying to assert something, which is life is no more than a candle, which connects us, of course, back to the light. And what he is calling for is his own demise. It is saying, let this candle go out. Let my life end. Let the light in me perish. But it is an admission, if it is a candle, even if it's brief, what is still there? Light. Light. And remember as well, what has prompted this speech is the death of his wife. It's the death of his wife. We are talking about death. He wants to join her. He wishes to join her. Out, out, brief candle. Here we go. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player. This is incredible again. All I can say, if you're having trouble following this, you should. It is metrically, the rhythm is disordered. As is the subject matter. As is the man's mind. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player. We get the inverted first syllable again. The pattern is broken right at the beginning. It's what's called a trochee. Life's but a walking shadow. And for a little moment, we get regular rhythm, but it's surrounded by such irregularity, it seems to halt along. Listen. Life's but a walking shadow. Hear it? Life's but a bum, 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 bum. Walking shadow. It halts. The verse becomes regular, but the regularity seems out of place. It's surrounded by so much disorder. Life's but a walking shadow. Now, the walking shadow, the shadow in Elizabethan stage terms, was an actor who has a very, very small, insignificant part. We would call it, it survives in our phrase, a walk-on. Okay? It was called the shadow player, a shadow. It means you're in the play, but your part is absolutely insignificant. But suddenly we get a theater metaphor as well. And suddenly we're aware of the actor stating these words in a theater, talking about playing an insignificant part. Life's but a walking shadow, and then he picks up the metaphor. A poor player. Poor, does it mean, does it, what, having lost all wealth? That's appropriate, because at this moment, the wealth of knowledge, the wealth of soul has left Macbeth. Does it mean bad actor? It certainly could. Again, we're getting more miles per gallon out of our words. There are different meanings in a single phrase. A poor player, a lousy actor. Life's but a walking shadow, you don't give him big parts. A poor player, just a miserable actor. A poor player, but remember petty pace? Petty pace, double P, he repeats it here. It's not accidental. What do we get again? Puh, 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 puh. He's spitting again at life. But where that was petty pace, we now get poor player. Stretching. This speech is filled with one long vowel sound after another. Poor player, and it ends with another weak ending. Double weak ending. Weakness, weakness. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage. And we get why now the player is lousy. He's one of those who's out there strutting around thinking he's important and fretting, making a lot of noise, showing off. We call it playing to the balcony, being a ham. And yet, the word fret also means to worry. And it also means to tear something apart. Words with multiple meanings. And he only gets an hour. Please notice what's happening to time. We've gone from tomorrow, 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 We've gone through day to day, and now we're down to an hour. Time is shrinking as the speech goes on. Time is getting shorter and shorter. A poor player that struts and frets his hour, and in order to make us understand it, notice what he does. Listen to the sounds. A poor player, and he sets up the R sounds in the preceding line. A poor player that struts and frets his hour, and we hear the player ranting and raving. It's in the verse, and the actor can do it. A poor player that struts and frets his hour. It's in the sound. Actors love to play Shakespeare because he does all your work for you. The sounds are right there. All you have to do is emphasis. And in those sounds, you get the bigness, the phoniness. It's in the verse. It's in the sound. That struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. And then is heard no more. And now finally we hit the end of time. We've gone from tomorrow and tomorrow, day to day, yesterday, hour, and now, no more. In order to give us the sense of it, they both get accented. And then is heard no more. Notice the O sounds. No more. Tomorrow and tomorrow. He is repeating the same sound he began the speech with. When we finally hit, if you will, that end of time. An actor has an hour to rant and rave, and then it's over. Macbeth has his hour to rant and rave in Scotland, and then it's over. The actor playing Macbeth has his chance to rant and rave. The play's almost over. And Shakespeare is always aware of that artificiality of the theater and throws it at us because it's like life. And he's saying it again. It's phony. It's all make-believe. It's going to go away. This is pure nihilism. And then comes that awful finish. It is a tale. It is a tale told by an idiot full of sound and fury. Told by an idiot. Oh, we get the lot. This whole speech. Oh. If you're aware of the vowel sounds, you hear the moaning. Remember how it began? A cry of women off stage. It begins with oh and ends with toe. No more. Ah, those long O sounds are everywhere in the speech. Told by an idiot. Told has some force, but the word idiot itself has changed from fool, again, double O's, to now what? Idiot, idiot, idiot. Those little I sounds, idiot, idiot, and it's suddenly made small. The sound of the word that he chooses, is a tiny, pathetic little word made up of a lot of little vowel sounds, 1D, 1T, idiot, idiot. It is a tale, okay, told by an idiot. And the words just go pull up. Because he has set it up with, again, notice, tale told. He leads into tale with, it is a tale. It is a tale. It. And we get the double it sounds. It's not accidental. I say to my students, it is always a weak beginning for a sentence. It is. He knew it. He uses it. It is a tale told by an idiot. Because the sounds are accumulating. Full of sound and fury. Weak ending. Falls off again. But of course we get full of sound and fury, which takes us back in sound to what? Struts and frets. S and F, if you will. Okay. Strut, fret, sound, fury. He's duplicating the sounds. And we get the R sounds, okay, repeated. Ow. Oh, see that? Okay, here we go. Okay, we've had this sound before. What was the sound? What was the empty sound? It was the out. Okay. Fury, full. Everything's coming together. Everything's accumulating. All the sounds are bouncing off each other. And then we get, notice, signifying nothing. It's the end of the speech. The line is three.
Okay.
Signifying nothing. It is exactly half a line. We have to fill in the rest, which is emptiness and void, which is his point. Signifying nothing. Notice what is happening here. Those little short I sounds are accumulating.
Si-ni-fe-i-na-fi-n.
Back from the i-i. Okay. I-i. And the pattern's repeated here. I. There are 1, 2, 3, 4 of them in that 2.5 feet. I would say, in one sense, if I were an actor preparing the role, if I were a director working with an actor, I would make the actor run around and do the whole speech just doing the vowel sounds. It's the difference between the moaning of a human soul, perhaps echoing the moaning of the women off stage, and the sounds a chimpanzee makes. One could almost say nihilism is filled with those very sounds, those short eyes. Okay. And what he is doing is giving us the sounds of the idiot. We hear the sounds of the idiot. Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in its petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time, and all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. Silence. The reason the speech is so well known is that it is a perfect example of meaning and sound coming together. The sounds are unforgettable, whether you know it or not. The poetry is working on you. The poetry is working on you. It is imprinting its horror on your soul because of the way in which the poet wrote it. I've taken a lot of time on this, but let me just say, imagine, if you will, this is what goes on when you rehearse Shakespeare with an actor, okay? If I were directing it, I would take the time, go through the speech with the actor. We have learned things here. In Shakespeare, character, language is character. And poetry gives clues to the language, gives clues to the character. What would I say, okay, having gone through this? It might change the next time one looked at it. One might discover different things. The riches just keep opening up. What would I say? It is a combination of absolute pain and gibbering nonsense in terms of the sound. It is a vision of calm that begins with calm despair tomorrow and ends in ranting. And ends in ranting and then becomes very tiny. The sounds tell us that. It tells us about Macbeth. It is, if you will, an encapsulation of the entire play. A grand, sonorous beginning that ends up very tiny and small. He refers to these giant's robes that dwarf him. He's aware he's made small. In the speech, we go, that happens in the sound. It's one speech. If you're doing Macbeth, it's a matter of going through this over and over again. Over and over again. Let me give you two other quick examples from other plays.
just to emphasize the point that this isn't happening randomly.
Let me give you two lines from Hamlet's death.
Talking about Macbeth.
Even the markers have turned. The red one.
All right. Yeah, it's better. Okay. I should have done the Macbeth speech in red.
Hamlet is speaking to Horatio. Hamlet is dying. Horatio says, "I am yet more antique Roman than Dane," and grabs the poison cup in an attempt to commit suicide. And Hamlet knocks the poison cup out of his hand and says, "Absent thee from felicity a while, and in this harsh world draw thy breath in pain to tell my story." How many words in this line? Just count them. "Absent thee from felicity a while." Five. How many words in this line? 10. He has doubled the number of words. We have the same length of line. It means it takes twice as long to say this line as this one, and yet in terms of poetry, they're the same length. They are both iambic pentameter. "Absent thee from felicity a while." Got it? "Absent thee from felicity a while, and in this harsh world draw thy breath in pain." "Absent thee from felicity a while." We only have three accents, and which means only five words, and the line goes by even faster. "Absent thee from felicity a while," and it's all short vowel sounds. "And in this harsh world draw thy breath in pain." Notice what happens as well with the sounds. "Harsh world draw breath." Got long vowel sounds again, but even more, we've got R, 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 R. And we have plosives. We've got the H sound here. Th, hit, okay? Th. Hamlet is dying, and you can hear it in the sound. "Absent thee from felicity a while, and in this harsh world draw thy breath in pain to tell my story." Okay? He has a couple more words, but that's essentially the end of it. The line is twice as long. It's loaded with R sounds. It is loaded with pain. Shakespeare's done the work for the actor. You get an actor just to speak it clearly, and you get the feeling. "Absent thee from felicity." Very soft, very gentle, very nice. "Absent thee from felicity a while, and in this harsh world draw thy breath in pain." And it takes a lot more breath to say this than it does to say that. One last example. From Cleopatra's death in Antony and Cleopatra. This is my favorite. I love this one. Cleopatra dies by applying a snake to her bosom. As a friend of mine says, she clasps her asp to her bosom and dies. The snake comes in. She puts the snake on her breast. The snake bites her, and the venom, the poison, fills her system. She dies. She has the snake at her breast, and her maids are weeping. And she says to her maids, "Hush. Hush, dost thou not see my baby at my breast that sucks the nurse asleep?" A curious inversion. A baby, of course, draws milk from the breast of the mother and gets life. This snake is putting liquid into the breast of the woman and causing death. And yet, Shakespeare gives Cleopatra a life-affirming image at that point. She is glad to be going, and it's a positive sense. But more than that, he is telling us what's happening in the sound. Hush, hush, dost thou not see my baby at my breast that sucks the nurse asleep? What do you hear? The snake is hissing all the way through the lines. You can just hear, hush, hush, dost thou not see my baby at my breast that sucks the nurse asleep? And you can just see him chuckling as he wrote the words down on the page. It's very technical, but it's part of the greatness and the genius of what we're dealing with here. And you can take any moment in any play, look at it closely, and it starts opening up. It just starts opening up. It is the glory and the greatness of poetry, and the reason there is it's the reason why this man is acclaimed as the greatest poet to ever write in the English language, and probably in any other language. It's an extraordinary brilliance. My students always ask,
"But did he know he was doing that?" Did he put all that in there?
And the answer, of course, is it's hardly possible. He was turning out three of these a year. I mentioned earlier this afternoon to someone, we have one account of how Shakespeare wrote. Only one account. There was an eyewitness who saw him writing, who reported it, and was mocking the other great master of the day, Ben Jonson, who took forever writing his work and revised and corrected and, you know, made changes here and rewrote, said, "Master Shakespeare never blotted out a line." Jonson said, "Would he had blotted 1,000. You know, there was a friendly rivalry between the two. But the fact of the matter is, apparently Shakespeare wrote, "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in, penny paste from day to day to the last album recorded." God, it's coming, Burbage, it's coming, don't worry. Here it is. Now that speech is done. Leave me alone, I got more to do. On we go. Never blotted out a line. He didn't make corrections. How, you know, and we say, how is this possible? Well, it's the stuff of genius. And it's the reason why we study the works of the great geniuses to remind ourselves that we may be human, but we are touched with something miraculous. And at our greatest, at our best, we can do amazing work. And it seems very clear to me that there can only be one source for that kind of inspiration, and that's what it is. Yeah.
Sounds exactly like Mozart.
It's exactly like Mozart. You know, Mozart was once asked, you know, how do you do that? He said, "Well, you know, it's just up there, and I just put it down." You know, and the question, well, then where does it come from? Well, we know where it comes from. These were not arrogant, proud men. Shakespeare did not bother to have his own plays published. He never collected them. Fortunately, two of his friends did, or we wouldn't have about half of them. He didn't care. It was work. He earned a living, supported his family. Mozart, hardworking. In his own day, you know, not desperately trying to get commissions to write operas. Greatest opera composer that ever lived. Pleading, "Please let me write one. Get out of here. I'm trying to find Salieri. He'll write me an opera." It stymies the student who has no sense of the human soul. It stymies the student who cannot understand inspiration. And that God in His majesty touches some men with this remarkable power to create beauty. And to give us a sense, to help explain to us the world in which we live. It is a great gift. And many of them who have that gift are quite humble men. The butcher's boy from Stratford with an 8th grade education. It's the reason why there are many people who insist he can't have written those plays. With an 8th grade education, couldn't have done it. A commoner, he couldn't have done it. Well, that's the way God works. That's the way God works. And it's a great mystery. It's a great gift. All we can do is be grateful for it. But also study it as a reminder of what human beings are capable of. And to remind ourselves of beauty in the world at a time when the world is sadly lacking in beautiful. I would say this, for all the evil in the play, that is a beautifully constructed speech, even if its subject matter is not beautiful. And there is, in the very fact that it could be expressed with that kind of passion, with that kind of specificity, with that incredible imagination, even then there is a sense of that which uplifts. It is uplifting. It is uplifting. It is not a modern vision of nihilism which would just be grunting and groaning and shrieking. That is insufficient. So that even the vision of nothingness can be expressed with beauty. And in that, there is a contradiction that there is something more than just nothingness, even there. As I tried to hint, in this dark speech, there are still glimmers of light in the soul of Macbeth. The light has not yet gone out.
You say in that one line, she should have died hereafter. He could have been referring to her soul because he's acknowledging in his mind that she's one of the incarnate devils that took the movies. And he doesn't care enough.
That would suggest a kind of self-recognition on his part that I don't see elsewhere. I think the little references to light here are almost accidental. I don't see him bother. I don't see him caring enough to pass judgment on his own wife at that point. I see it as dismissive.
But you said about the devils, something I shouldn't believe will stop
him. Oh, exactly. Yes, yes. Then those juggling fiends are no more to be believed. Yeah. That seems to me to have directly to do with the prophecies that come from the witches in Act 4. And in a way, he has moved his allegiance from his wife to those witches themselves. It's one reason why she gets dismissed and essentially vanishes from the play. He is now, if she has been an agent of evil, he is now going to the source. He's going to the source and she becomes unimportant. We do not see them together after Act 3. They never appear together again. Lady Macbeth has only one other scene, and it is the sleepwalking scene in which she's been taken over by her guilt and has gone mad. In fact, that glorious moment where the doctor says, more she needs the divine than the physician. The doctor knows. She doesn't need a doctor. She needs a clergyman fast. And that recognition is there. Those recognitions are all the way through. A speech that was cut from the production that comes in Act 4, Scene 3. The references that are made to Edward the Confessor. I can find it here quickly. Fascinating little moment in the play. No. Enter a doctor. There are doctors. Two different doctors appear at various points at the end of this play. Obviously, the doctor that watches Lady Macbeth and makes that claim, she doesn't need a doctor. She needs someone quite different. Well, more anon, comes the king forth, I pray, the doctor has asked. Aye, sir. There are a crew of wretched souls that stay his cure. Their malady convinces the great assay of art, but at his touch, such sanctity hath given his heaven hath heaven given his hand, they presently amend. Okay? What's this disease he means? 'Tis called the evil. A most miraculous work in this good king, which often since my here remain in England I have seen him do. How he solicits heaven, himself best knows. But strangely visited people, all swollen and ulcerous, pitiful to the eye, the mere despair of surgery, he cures. Hanging a golden stamp about their necks, put on with holy prayers. And 'tis spoken to the succeeding royalty, he leaves the healing benediction. With this strange virtue, he hath a heavenly gift of prophecy, and sundry blessings hang about his throne that speak him full of grace. Full of grace. echoes there, obviously. But the sense is there is, it's a brief moment in this play. That's all we hear of. But there is, heaven's blessing can be there. There can be heavenly prophecy. There can be the good, there can be, as the evil king is destroying a kingdom, there can be a good king who heals a kingdom. That possibility exists, and it's mentioned there. That is cut from almost every production I've ever seen. It's absurd. It's sinful. It's absolutely sinful. And those words of the doctor coming and reporting that sets up the doctor in the last act as well. There is a possibility of healing here. It's a possibility. It's not accepted by those who have separated themselves. Oh, yes, yes, yes. Shakespeare's tragedies always have... It's called comic relief. It's no such... Well, I'm not sure how much of a relief it is. It is comedy. Opening of scene 3. The murder is committed, and suddenly we hear the knocking on the gate. Okay, it is, if you will, it's the knocking of conscience. You cannot keep the world outside. It's going to intrude. It's going to come in. The body's going to be discovered. The porter is drunk. Here's a knocking indeed. If a man were porter of Hellgate, he should have old turning the key. Okay, he imagines himself the porter at the gate of hell, opening the gate to let the damned souls in. But he's saying, if a man were porter of that gate, he'd grow old. He'd open the door, and he'd open the door, and there'd be another knocking, he'd open the door again. And the vision is of souls, just, you know, an endless parade of them into hell. Knock, knock, knock. Hadn't noticed that. It sounds again. Knock, knock, knock. Who's there in the name of Beelzebub? Here's a farmer that hanged himself on the expectation of plenty. I hadn't noticed this. This is why you work with these things. It's amazing. Remember, I quoted the speech earlier, Banquo, to the witches. If you can look into the seeds of time and say which will grow and which is not. We now have a farmer growing grain. And the porter is imagining it's a farmer who was hoarding his crops in the expectation of good times ahead, and it doesn't happen, and it's, you know, so he hangs himself. It is, again, it's a comic version of looking into the future. It is a grain reference. It is a seed reference. And it looks forward to Macbeth's, spill all the seeds at once and until destruction sicken. Come in time, have napkins enough about you. Here you'll sweat for it. Okay, it's very hot down here. You better bring some cloth with you to wipe your brow off. Knock, knock, who's there in the devil's name? Faith, here's an equivocator that could swear in both the scales against either scale, who committed treason enough for God's sake, yet could not equivocate to heaven. It's a lashing out at those equivocators. Certain holy men of the time who would talk their way around any argument, okay? But finally aren't quite able to equivocate their way to heaven. Door is open for them, okay? Knock, knock, who's there? Faith, here's an English tailor come hither for stealing out of a French hose. The tight-fitting hose, the stockings that were worn. Come in, tailor, here you may roast your goose. Another word for a pressing iron, okay? An iron. Knock, knock, never at quiet. What are you? But this place is too cold for hell. He says, I can't be in hell. It's too cold here. I'll devil port it no further. I had thought to have let in some of all the professions that go the primrose way to the everlasting bonfire. I was going to keep opening the door until one of every profession had wandered in. But again, the vision is the castle has become hell. And in come the souls, okay, to be damned by coming in. I pray you remember the porter. Macduff says, you know, what was it so late, friend, ere you went to bed that you lie so late? Faith, sir, we were carousing till the second cock. And drink, sir, is a great provoker of three things. We get this discussion of drink. Reason being, again, what is it? It's overindulgence, and it is taking away that sense of conscience and shame. But it's, again, we're getting the same themes presented in a comic vein. Mary, sir, nose painting, sleep, and urine. That's, if you drink too much, okay, drink provokes three things. It'll turn your nose red, it paints it red, sleep, it'll put you out, and urine. Lechery, sir, it provokes and unprovokes. It provokes the desire, but it takes away the performance. Therefore, much drink may be said to be an equivocator with lechery. It makes him and it mars him. It sets him on and it takes him off. The battle lost and won. It's the same pattern from the witches at the beginning. But now it's the drunken porter saying it, and at least he knows he's joking. It persuades him and disheartens him, makes him stand to and not stand to. In conclusion, equivocates him in a sleep, and giving him the lie leaves him. I believe drink gave thee the lie last night, says McNutt. That it did, sir, in the very throat on me, but I requited him for his lie, and I think, being too strong for him, though he took up my leg sometime, yet I make a shift to cast him. Okay, it's a... And the porter goes off to get rid of, to make a shift to cast off drink. I mean, it's a, even the comic characters in Shakespeare have just masterful language. But it's again, it's funny and it's not so fighting. And again, what's it all about? Equivocation, playing word games, playing games with truth and falsehood. With life and death, with heaven and hell. And it's no game. It's no game what's gone on there that night in the castle. It's a stunning little scene that sets things off. Yes?
How is it that such a simple phrase as to be or not to be could dumbfound the entire world?
I'll tell you quite honestly, because I think it's... in one sense, it defines the modern world. To be or not to be, that is the question. In a curious way, Hamlet seems to me one of the defining moments for the modern world, a place where the modern world begins. It's very interesting. Hamlet has a soliloquy in Act One. Oh, that this too solid flesh would melt, thaw, and resolve itself into a dew. Or, that the everlasting had not fixed his canon against self-slaughter. I wish God had not written down as law, you may not kill yourself. That's a soliloquy in Act One. We come to Act Three, and Hamlet is saying something similar, to be or not to be, that is the question. He's still thinking about suicide, but in Act One he says, can't do it because God has forbidden it. By Act Three, he's cast off God. And it is simply a question in isolation. To exist or not to exist, that's the only question. No mention any longer of God's law, and it is part of his descent into an abyss in Act 3. And in that sense, if the modern world it has basically taken to itself a false vision of existence and reality, then it has chosen suicide. And the question for every man, in a sense, for every modern man, is do you choose life or do you choose death? The great British writer and commentator Malcolm Muggeridge once wrote an essay called The Great Liberal Death Wish, in which he defines all liberalism in the modern world as a death wish. That's what's haunting Hamlet. Hamlet is desperately trying to find a reason to live. And suicide has entered his mind, and suicide haunts the modern world, individually, nationally, and finally, in terms of the whole human race. Do we choose to live, and that means in accord with God's will and plan, or do we choose to end it all? And I think that's the reason it's been picked up, and everyone knows it. It's the most famous line he ever wrote. Everyone knows it. It defines us. It's sadly still the question. And in this play, clearly... Macbeth doesn't even have that question. He chooses death. And he becomes an agent of that death wish. He becomes an agent, an arm of the devil who is destroying all life. And in the process destroys his own soul. Frightening. Yes?
Do you think Shakespeare made up a lot of words to make his thing?
It's interesting. I sincerely believe he made them up because he needed them. And couldn't find just what he wanted. Let me give you a very quick example. In Measure for Measure, there's a word that occurs it's the only two places in the whole English language it ever occurs. It's the word prenzy, P-R-E-N-Z-I-E, Prenzi. In both cases, it refers to Angelo. We have no idea what it means. It doesn't appear anywhere else in any literature. He made it up. I play the game with my students early in the semester, and I put the word on the board and say, now, you don't know what it means. No, no, none of them knows. However, I say, tell me certain things about this character, Prenzi. Is he of high station or low? They say, he's of high rank. I said, that's right. Okay. Is he a humble man, or is he a proud man? They say, you know, or is he full of himself? They say, he's full of himself. That we go down, and they can give me a whole list of characteristics that describe Angelo just from the word that they don't know the meaning of, which again is my point that words, the sound of words can carry meaning. So he made it up. He used it there. It does describe Angelo. He is the Prenzi Angelo. There's no doubt about it. Although you won't find it in any dictionary. But again, it's that power of invention. The word's not there. Oh, I need just that word. Well, okay, I'll create it. It's amazing. It's what the most learned man to ever write the English language was Milton. Highly educated, brilliant mind, used every word possible. In his works, he uses a vocabulary of 18,000 words. Shakespeare used 22,000. 4,000 more than the learned Milton. Not bad for an 8th grade education. Stunning. It's simply stunning. Oh, that's enough. Thank you. Thank you and good night. I'll be around tomorrow morning in the early part of the afternoon. Be glad to chat with you. If you bump into me or come and visit me, I'm upstairs. Thank you again.